Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanall. I'm your host. Now, we're just not even 2 weeks into the Obama administration, and things are already heating up with regard to communication and telecom. So I'm going to try and catch up with some of the stuff, and some stuff that might be lurking under the surface you might not have caught. You do want to stay tuned. So periodically here on the Media Geek Radio Show, I like to catch up with news of our media environment, things that happen in telecom policy, things that happen in regulation, that might happen on the legal front, that I think deserve coverage, a little looking underneath the hood, if you will, because these stories normally only show up on the business pages of our major newspapers. Once in a while, though, leaking up to the front, like digital television, which I'll get to in a moment, but more or less usually being treated like stuff that's only of interest to shareholders or people who are looking to make money in the media. Not as if it's important to our very democracy. So I try and cover them here. And some of these stories, you know, like the digital television transition is something which is getting a lot of mainstream media play now, finally, that it is mere weeks away and things look to be not in good shape. And it's something I've been covering here on Media Geek for years. But first off, just want to make a quick note that there is a new chairman in the House over in FCC land. Actually, just an acting chairman, FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, a Democrat, longstanding member of the FCC, has been named acting chairman until President Obama has the opportunity to bring his choice for the position, Julius Genachowski, and get him confirmed by the Senate. There's a little bit of a line over there right now. You might recall, if you're listening to the January 16th edition of the radio show, I talked about Genachowski and much of what is known about this shadowy guy with our man who watches the FCC, Matthew Lessard. It's at the Media Geek website at radio.mediageek.net if you want to catch up on that. That leaves us with just three FCC commissioners right now out of a usual five. Michael Copps, a Democrat, now acting chair. Jonathan Adelstein, also a Democrat, and Robert McDowell, a Republican, a Bush appointee, filling three of the five seats. So once we see a new chairman in place, it's likely President Obama will get to work appointing another FCC commissioner. This one will have to be a Republican. Two out of the five should be Republicans, with a Democrat in the executive. But as we go to air here on January 29th, the House of Representatives has delayed decision on a proposed delay of the upcoming digital TV transition, still set to happen on February 17th. That's the day when analog TVs no longer will receive most over-the-air signals. Actually, low-power television stations will continue to broadcast in analog for the foreseeable future. Most of those are either non-commercial stations or a lot of them rebroadcast MTV2 or the Home Shopping Network. So you will be able to continue to shop on television even if you can't watch anything on primetime. The bill to delay the transition until June 12th passed the Senate unanimously, full bipartisan support, on January 26th, and was set to go through the House on their suspension calendar, which is used to expedite non-controversial bills by letting them bypass the usual process of consideration by committee before a full floor vote. But such a route then requires a two-thirds vote by the full House, which it failed to receive, with 258 yeses and 169 noes, splitting largely along party lines, with Republicans making up most of the opposition. So now the bill has to go to committee review before a full vote by the House. Since it enjoys so much support by the Democrats, it's unlikely It will have problem in committee review, provided that the House has time for that. One of the reasons they were trying to push it through the suspension calendar was indeed in order to save time, because they certainly have a lot of other things going on there in Congress. And that may, though, happen as soon as the first week of February. But in the background here, the New York Times covered the digital TV transition woes with a story that came up on the front page of the website, at the very least. Nielsen ratings estimates that 6.5 million households are still not yet ready for digital TV. It's estimated that many of those are poorer, more economically depressed households. And right now, 2.6 million people are on a waiting list for a converter box coupon to help facilitate the transition to digital. As you've probably heard, you can get a $40 coupon from the federal government towards the purchase of a converter box, which costs somewhere between $40 and $70. For some folks, it may not seem like a lot of money. Certainly, though, it's a lot cheaper than a new television. So it'll allow your old analog set to pick up digital signals, which they will not otherwise be able to do. That's 2.6 million people still waiting. Looks like they underestimated the demand a little bit. It was actually a huge fight in Congress when that bill got passed, which allocated $1.5 billion for the transition. But the House economic stimulus bill that just passed includes another $650 million to help bolster the converter box fund and also bring about more digital television education. Now, both interim FCC Chairman Michael Cobbs and Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein have supported the delay of the transition, primarily because they've been critical of the preparations made by the federal government, including the Federal Communications Commission, in getting people ready to make the transition, be it allocating sufficient funds for the converter boxes or making sure that there's sufficient number of people manning telephones to take complaint calls or questions that people have about the transition on February 17th, when their analog TVs are currently set to become mostly obsolete by legislative fiat. We don't see that happen too often. So, but if the bill does pass the House, it's likely that President Obama will sign it, which would push the transition until June 12th. So speaking of the House stimulus bill that passed on January 28th, it also includes $350 million for a broadband data collection effort to allow states to track and specifically map the availability of broadband access, $2.85 billion to implement a wireless and broadband deployment grants program, with $1 billion of that going to wireless. And something that makes a lot of network neutrality advocates very happy, the grants come with open access stipulations. And the Senate Appropriation Committee's version of the bill, which was just revealed, includes the mandate that networks built with funds given by the federal government adhere to non-discrimination and network interconnection mandates. So it looks like instead of necessarily being floated as a individual bill for network neutrality, some degree of network neutrality will be required by any ISPs who receive these federal funds. And don't doubt for a moment that AT&T, Comcast, Cox Communications, Verizon et al. Will be pushing each other out of the way, getting in line to get these broadband stimulus checks. Although also don't doubt that they won't be bitching and moaning all the way about the open access requirements. But speaking of impediments to open access and non-discrimination, Cox Communications, which is a cable modem provider, is set to test a bandwidth management system that may cause what they're calling momentary delays to internet applications the company says are not time sensitive, such as peer-to-peer file sharing. Such a scheme would privilege streaming video downloads over other traffic, like regular old downloads, maybe software downloads, and other file transfers, in addition to file sharing traffic. And this would happen during times of congestion. Already, that plan is drawing fire from the public interest community, who see little difference between Cox's proposed strategy and Comcast's BitTorrent filtering, for which the latter received a stiff rebuke from the FCC and the ire of millions and millions of internet users around the country. Public Knowledge's Alex Curtis points out in their policy blog that actually a lot of live video is being broadcast on the internet using peer-to-peer technology. In fact, it's what CNN used to stream the inauguration. And I might make note of that a little later, but a lot of people couldn't get any live streams of the inauguration due to there being so much traffic, and CNN's was perhaps one of the more reliable ones, which required not everyone, but some people who chose to download a small application update, which enabled this peer-to-peer file sharing approach. And apparently a lot more people to watch it than might have otherwise been able to. And in fact, more than a year ago, I reported here on the show and on my blog, MediaGeek.net, on BitTorrent's commercial protocol for peer-to-peer distribution of video on the web, which differs from the publicly available version of the protocol used for distributing free software or other file sharing. And earlier this year, I questioned someone from BitTorrent during a phone press conference about the fact that BitTorrent said, well, we don't think there'll be problems with ISPs blocking our commercial protocol, the one which we're selling to people to help distribute video for commercial purposes, because we'll probably be able to make arrangements with ISPs directly. That's the commercial side. Whereas on the non-commercial side, the free protocol, which people use to distribute software and all sorts of things, including sometimes share copyright works without permission, that'll all get blocked. And I put it to them directly. So does that mean we're talking about, say, a parallel internet where it's pay for play? And they did say, though, that the company advocates for net neutrality in general. So we'll see about that. So right now, both Public Knowledge and another press freedom group, Free Press, are calling on the FCC to examine Cox's apparently discriminatory management plan. So if you are a Cox Internet customer, you may want to start watching to see how your downloads come the next time you need to get an update to your Windows or Mac OS operating system, or you want to download some new software or anything else, even while maybe some live video or YouTube video might be expedited instead. I guess whether or not it's time sensitive is really a matter of opinion, depending on how bad you need the software you're downloading. And never mind how much you're paying to guarantee a certain level of download speed overall. That's a different question. Now, there is a plus side here, not about Cox, but a new set of internet and network management measurement tools has just been announced. It's called MLab. Google is one of the companies involved in this group putting together, and it's open source free tools that will let you uncover so-called network management and other blocking that might be happening, like what Comcast was doing to its customers, blocking BitTorrent, and figure out when your internet seems slow, is it my computer or is something fishy going on? And they're open source, which means that the code behind it is being made free so that other developers might be able to adapt it and create even more fine-grained tools, maybe easier-to-use tools. Already, some of the tools have been released, and they work in the browser. So it should be kind of interesting to see how that turns out. It's turning into a bit of an arms race, if you will. A bit of a cat-and-mouse game with internet service providers figuring out ways to degrade the performance of particular applications rather than actually just building out capacity. I don't know, that might work too, since most of us pay for our internet. But what do I know? Anyway, you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesodel, and I'm your host. Media Geek is online with the Media Geek blog. It's at www.mediageek.net. It's where I blog about news and views on our media environment, a lot of opinions, sometimes musing about subjects. There's not much time to do so on a radio show. Last week on the program, we talked about retro technology with Bohus Blahut of RetroThing.com. And over the last month or so, I've blogged quite a bit about some of my own experiences with so-called retro technology and about the supposed death of VHS videotape, which I opine to be kind of blown out of proportion on a slow news day rather than indicative of any sort of imminent death of the most popular ever home video format. All sorts of things like that. It's at MediaGeek.net. The radio show's at Radio.MediaGeek.net. It's where you can download the program or subscribe to the podcast, listen in your browser. It's whether that's the way you want to get the program. And I know hundreds of you do every single week. Or if you want to catch it when you missed it, it's all there at Radio.MediaGeek.net. Of course, catch the Twitter feed. All sorts of musings from me in 140 characters or less to twitter.com/MediaGeek. And if you have any comments, hey, you can do them by Twitter. If you're a Twitter user, you could send me a tweet. Just stick an @ in front of MediaGeek and give me 140 characters of comments, or you can send me an old-fashioned email, paul@MediaGeek.net. Well, so one thing that's on a lot of people's minds right now, of course, is the press and whether or not newspapers are going to survive. Here on Media Geek, we certainly have covered the problems that Tribune Company is having here in the backyard of Media Geek in Chicago, where the company is based. Of course, the company has newspapers all over the country and other media properties around the country. So it's not just a regional, it's not just a Chicago problem. And Tribune is by no means alone. Every single day, we hear news of layoffs and other really bad financial cutbacks happening in newspapers. And some newspapers, such as the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, may actually not be around very soon. So it's got a lot of folks wondering about what we might do to try and save the newspaper, since it's been a very vital part of American political culture, enshrined as it is in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Our founding fathers believed to be essential to the functioning of a democratic government that there be a free press. And while certainly news and information flows on the internet in many different ways besides a newspaper, there's a great tradition in the United States for newspapers being the home of very vibrant speech and especially investigative journalism. Journalism that might take up thousands of words rather than just 2 to 3 minutes of airtime. There is a difference. Well, according to Chicago Reader's Michael Miner, former WBEZ program director Ken Davis is organizing a 3-hour forum dedicated to saving local journalism in Chicago, scheduled for February 22nd in the Walnut Room of the Hotel Allegro down in the Loop. The lineup includes Tribune columnist Eric Zorn, former Sun-Times media writer Rob Fetter, NBC's Carol Marin, author Alex Kotlowitz, Salim Muwakkil from In These Times, a great investigative news magazine based in Chicago, Columbia College journalism professor Barbara Iverson, Tom Clark of the Community Media Workshop, Michael Miner calls master blogger and former Sun-Times architecture critic Lee Bay, the Chi-Town Daily News founding editor Jeff Doherty, along with Miner himself. That's something I'm hoping that I might be able to go and watch there on February 22nd. Details about how you can attend and all the rest have yet to be revealed, but as soon as I know, I'll certainly share it on the Media Geek website at MediaGeek.net and here on the program. And with luck, I'll be able to go there and bring you back some audio snippets as well. Apparently already, forums like this have been held in other cities. And certainly, ideas about helping to continue to keep journalism, especially local journalism, alive in Chicago will be relevant to other cities and towns around the U.S. and around the world. And with regard to newspapers, you might have heard the news that French President Nicolas Sarkozy has just pledged $750 million or so in aid for his nation's newspapers as part of the effort. Every 18-year-old in France will be given a year subscription to the paper of her choice. And tax breaks will go to investors in online papers, and the French government will double its print and web advertising budget, helping to also pump some money into the news sector there. And in a similar vein, Yale University's chief investment officer, David Swensen, co-authored an op-ed in a January 27th New York Times recommending turning newspapers into endowed nonprofit institutions like universities in order to save them. Swensen and co-author Michael Schmidt, a financial analyst, observed that, quote, "We are dangerously close to having a government without newspapers," end quote. Endowments, they argue, would enhance newspapers' autonomy while shielding them from the economic forces that are now tearing them down. Swensen and Schmidt predict that newspapers will continue to suffer as long as they remain for-profit enterprises, noting that despite attracting 20 million unique users to the New York Times website in October 2008, the revenues from the website of the business, from the website only support an estimated 20% of the paper's staff. They also point out that as nonprofits, newspapers would benefit from charitable tax exemptions under 501c3 of the IRS code. A $5 billion endowment is what they estimate a paper like The Times would require in order to maintain its $200 million a year cost to run. Now, as somebody who's worked in the non-commercial and non-profit media world now for going on about 20 years, certainly, I'm a fan of non-commercial media, and I see a lot of advantages to media being non-commercial, not the least of which is it shows promise for reducing the influence of outside, especially muddied forces, on journalism. When you don't have advertisers, it's hard for them to wield any power, hard for them to make demands, whether they are shielded or whether they are sort of more implicated rather than explicit demands that coverage be different, or else they'll pull their advertising dollars. It also means certainly then that you can focus strictly on the costs of creating the news, of creating newspapers, rather than also the further demand that there be a significant profit on top of that. And certainly one of my biggest criticisms of the news media, especially in the last 20 years or so, that we've seen through consolidation has been the increasing focus and over-focus on profit. I think to the extent to which looking for having unrealistic profit expectations from a business, which nevertheless tended to do very well, newspapers, but having starved them in many ways to death through consolidation, through putting properties together and therefore firing and laying off workers, shrinking newsrooms in order to get more profit out without actually putting out a better product, which brings us to where we are now. Certainly, I would be naive to say that the internet and the unique mode of information transfer it presents, along with other media, radio, television. I would be completely naive of me to say that those have not had an effect. But at the same time, I don't think you can change the context and the history of the intense consolidation and short-term myopic profit squeezing that has gone on before. But let me also put it on the flip side of working non-commercial and non-profit, because that is not necessarily easy either. Certainly the idea of an endowment makes a lot of sense. Certainly has provided a real cushion for major universities like Yale University or Northwestern University, which is a licensee for WNUR, where Media Geek is now being produced. But of course, an endowment is not a fail-safe, because endowments are usually made up by significant market investments. So as goes the market, so goes endowments, as major nonprofits and foundations have learned this year. They're not able to function at the levels they'd become accustomed to in the previous years when the stock market was going better, because they've seen their endowments take a pretty major hit. So it's not at all a fail-safe, although it may not pose the same sort of threat that papers are now seeing in terms of advertising and other revenue problems. I'll also point out $5 billion is an awful lot of money. So you do have to question, where is that $5 billion going to come from in the first place? The endowments of large universities like Harvard, or of large foundations like a MacArthur Foundation, were built up over many, many years to get to that level. In some cases, decades or more than a century to get to the level of billions of dollars. So not exactly a cure-all. We can also see, you know, that another esteemed news organization, National Public Radio, has a fairly large endowment given by the Kroc Estate. And yet that has not been enough to stave off having to have cutbacks and layoffs just recently in their both behind the scenes and on air staff. So it's not an overall panacea. As well, I'm not sure that nonprofit, being nonprofit, necessarily guarantees all the independence that people think it does. But that is yet to be seen. We've certainly seen that major universities are still dependent on donors to continue to make up whatever funding gaps they need to make up. And donations can often come with strings attached, or supposed strings attached. It's not all freedom there, as we've seen universities increasingly have to react more to so-called market forces, often at the expense of traditional humanities and other traditional modes of scholarship in exchange for taking research dollars and focusing maybe more on what one might call career training rather than strict academic endeavors. Nevertheless, it's interesting to see that conversation started, although we'll have to see where it goes. It is not a good time for the mainstream media, by and large. And I'll continue to watch and continue to have my critical viewpoints and bring on other people who have their critical viewpoints here on the Media Geek Radio Show. That brings to a close this edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, go to the Media Geek website at MediaGeek.net. And the radio show is at Radio.MediaGeek.net. You can download the program, listen in your browser, subscribe to the podcast to get it automatically into your computer or MP3 player. Whether you missed a program and you want to hear it again, or that's the way you prefer to do it, all at Radio.MediaGeek.net. And of course, follow the Twitter feed, why don't you? Twitter.com/MediaGeek. And the radio show is produced live in the studios of WNUR FM in Evanston and Chicago, on the campus of Northwestern University. And the program is also heard on lots of great stations, like founding station WEFT in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, 90.1 FM. Where it's heard Fridays at 5:30. Thanks for tuning in.